Hello and welcome to another weekend edition of Pacific Beat, coming to you from the Radio Australia studios in Melbourne. I'm Adam Connors. Over the next 24 minutes, we'll bring you a roundup of some of the stories that have made news on the program in the last couple of days. But first, Fiji's coup leader, Commodore Frank Bainimarama, has described consultations on the proposed new media decree as constructive. But many came out from the first consultation held with Fiji's media disappointed with what is being proposed, saying it will destroy the industry in the Pacific nation. Speaking on radio in New Zealand, Commodore Bainimarama says the proposal has support and he's dismissed the critics. Pacific correspondent Campbell Cooney reports.
When Fiji's coup leader and interim prime minister, Commodore Frank Bainimarama, spoke to New Zealand-based Indo-Fijian broadcaster Radio Tirana, his description was of a meeting in which all attending were happy with what they had heard.
I think they have come out of the consultations with a better appreciation of our government, which is to engage with the industry in taking our nation forward. Our government is asking for, in coming out with this media decree, is asking for the media industry to take greater responsibility and ownership in shaping a new and modern Fiji, to help lay a foundation that promotes equality and fairness and a high degree of ethics and moral principles.
But while Commodore Bainimarama describes the consultations on the decree as a form of asking for help from Fiji's media outlets, some of those who took part say it was more of an ultimatum. Speaking to the ABC on the condition their identity is not revealed, they believe the interim government's lawmakers and information officers were not so much interested in hearing how the proposed laws will make the media's activities more difficult, but were more interested in allowing Fiji's media to identify for them the loopholes which might allow reporters to bypass the new restrictions, and that when the decree is enacted, the only amendments that will be made will be a further tightening of what is described as already restrictive regulations. On this basis, our sources tell us some taking part in the consultations left early. When asked about the criticisms made about the proposed new regulations before and after the consultations, Commodore Bainimarama was unapologetic.
My message is for them to reconsider their positions. They need to understand the big picture and how government wishes to engage with them in taking the nation forward. Government cannot and will not allow vested interests to take over the national interest.
A reading of the draft decree shows that if you are found to be in breach of what Commodore Bainimarama identifies as the national interest, expect a fine of up to 100,000 Fijian dollars and possibly 5 years in jail. Your employer could be fined up to $500,000. While none of them are speaking publicly about the decree and its contents, it's understood that at the moment there are a lot of unhappy media owners, publishers and journalists in Fiji. Especially worried is the owner of the Fiji Times newspaper, Rupert Murdoch's News Limited Corporation. Under the decree, foreign ownership of any media operation will be limited to just 10%. In a statement from its corporate headquarters in Sydney, News Limited says the decree does raise important commercial issues for the Fiji Times that need careful consideration, and it is making representations to Fiji's interim government. Speaking on radio in New Zealand, Commodore Bainimarama indicated a change to ownership rules is unlikely.
The Fiji Times needs to ask itself how it is contributing to Fiji's overall development. The government is keen on attracting investors into the country and allowing them to flourish. However, government has also an overriding responsibility to ensure that the nation's overall interest is placed ahead of sectoral interests.
Fiji's interim Prime Minister, Commodore Frank Bainimarama, ending Campbell Cooney's report. Well, Fiji's Interim Attorney General, Ayaz Syed Kaum, also defended the contents of the new decree on Fiji's Legend FM. He says this sort of media law applies in several other countries.
Fiji is not alone in this. This draft decree is not alone in that aspect. America has that. The United States of America. Singapore has that. The numerous other countries that have this particular characteristic pertaining to the ownership of media. Now, obviously, this does not mean that it extends to all other sectors, but media being considered the fourth art of government, as it has been said, obviously plays a vital role. Now, any government obviously needs to have a sense of loyalty to the country of which it is the government of. And if media is part of government or the fourth arm of government, then obviously it needs to contribute to the country in which it operates.
But Mr. Syed Kaim, holding up Singapore as an example of a country with a good set of media laws, is certainly disputable. Professor Gary Rodan of the Asia Research Centre at Australia's Murdoch University says the ban on foreign ownership of media in Singapore, also proposed in Fiji's media decree, has led to increased levels of government control of information. Mr. Rodan is speaking to Bruce Hill.
In Singapore, the curbs on non-national ownership of media really were fought out, instituted in the 1970s. And the net effect of that was not just to mean that domestic media were owned and controlled by Singaporeans, but more particularly, it panned out that the strategic control of domestic media has been in the hands of government-linked companies. And that has applied not just to the printed press, which is where that battle took place during the 1970s in the first instance, but to electronic media, broadcasting media of all types, so that the domestic media is controlled now strategically by government-linked companies.
So do you think there's a danger with these sort of laws that this is the sort of thing that could happen, the media become more closely aligned to the government?
Well, the potential is obviously there.
So what does the media in Singapore look like as regards questions of press freedom and holding the government accountable?
Well, there isn't much holding of the government to account. The domestic media, and particularly the daily English language newspaper, the Straits Times, the editor and editors over time have been quite clear that they see themselves as part of a nation-building exercise, which means that they don't claim that they have a completely unrestrained free press or any obligation to provide that, rather that they see themselves working in concert with the Singapore government, and they refer to this as responsible media. If there's any accountability, I think it wouldn't be unreasonable to say that to some extent the media is accountable to the government for what it does, and that its senior editors don't have a real problem with that. And the appointment of editors and senior people in these media organisations is considered a very sensitive political and strategic exercise and is approached accordingly by the Singapore government.
So having seen this process take place in Singapore, now that you've heard the Fiji Interim Attorney General hold Singapore up as an example, what's your reaction to that?
I'd be concerned if I was a Fijian who wanted to see a robust and free domestic media.
Professor Gary Rodan of Murdoch University's Asia Research Centre. Still with Fiji, and a senior member of the Pacific's peak media body, the Pacific Islands News Association, has called for major changes in how the Suva-based organisation is run. PENA Vice President John Woods has highlighted serious internal issues and tells Claire Arthurs of his call for the organisation to be relocated outside of Fiji and away from censorship.
I've decided as Vice President, I'm so frustrated by the inaction and inefficiency of our organisation, and I mean at the administrative level and from the president down, that I'm publishing this Easter a memo to members, past members and future members, setting out the position, the problems within PENA, the lost opportunities that are going by, and the strong threat we have that the whole organisation will just collapse.
Have you reported your concerns to the donors who provide so much of your funding? And I'm thinking of AusAid and the EU, among others.
I've spoken with them. I haven't really enunciated this in writing. I know they share the concerns, many of them patiently waiting and hoping that PENA will come right.
Are you saying it's inefficiency and wastage or corruption in the organisation?
It could be both. And I'm open to challenge on that, but I'm also open to disclosure from our board, from the secretariat, of anything they may know I don't.
Have you raised your concerns with the president and the other administrative staff?
Absolutely. I'm now tarred with the brush of being negative and destructive. The general manager refused at first to even deal with me, said that I had some kind of ulterior motive to bring down the office, which is untrue. I just want some efficiency, some 21st century business practices to be followed. My main concern at the December meeting, we go all that way, funded by AusAid and others, to meet in Fiji. That's a board of six people. And we have no financial reports. I've still not seen one piece of paper with any figures to do with bank balances, expenditure, revenue from membership, revenue from subscriptions to PAC News. I can't even get the basics, and I am highly frustrated to the point I think we're in dire straits. The office needs to be suspended or put in abeyance.
Have you threatened to resign?
I have not threatened to resign. I was elected with the goodwill of those who were in Vanuatu to on a ticket, I suppose, of reform, of the need for restructuring, and I'm here to see it through.
John Woods, the Vice President of the Pacific Islands News Association. He's also the editor and publisher of the Cook Islands News. Attempts to contact Moses Stephen, the president of PINA, for his reaction to the allegations have so far been unsuccessful. The findings of the Tongan Royal Commission of Inquiry into the sinking of the government-owned inter-island ferry Princess Ashika has rocked the government since being leaked last week. But in the first few days of this current sitting of Parliament, the report has yet to be tabled. Despite setting up the Royal Commission, the authorities in Tonga were not very happy with the media's immediate desire to know what the three commissioners had found and recommended. But within hours of it being delivered to the King, the report's findings that the 74 deaths were senseless and it was scandalous that the unseaworthy and badly corroded Princess Ashika was bought and sent to sea were being widely reported. Information Minister Aseta Fusitua refused to answer questions, maintaining the report was not yet public.
It is not time to answer that question. Right? Firstly, I think you will agree that when one speaks on the subject, you should have at least read the material.
But she wasn't going to release it, something the Tongan online news site Matangi Tonga, which put the whole report on the web, made fun of. The publisher of Matangi Tonga, Pesi Fanua, says the government has in the past refused to release Royal Commission reports.
We thought it was going to be just like other Royal Commissions, right? But as it progressed, like I say, when we really got into the public hearing, I think that's when a lot of people start to realise that this is going to open up things and information will be really accessible and people can really find out what happened.
Relatives of the victims are demanding action.
Those leaders in the shipping corporation and in the government that was involved in the sailing of the Ashika should be sacked.
That's a call being echoed by Akilisi Bohiva, a people's representative to the Tongan Parliament.
So all in all, government failed in one way or the other in carrying out their duty, which eventually led to the purchasing of a vessel which was not seaworthy, which caused the sinking of the vessel and killing of 74 people. The whole cabinet should resign as soon as possible.
Four people, all officials, have so far been charged with manslaughter. But there could be more charges coming, some at the political level. The Tongan Police Commissioner, Chris Kelly.
The investigation and legal considerations will continue in respect of all aspects of this tragedy as police collect further evidence and seek legal opinion on the culpability of all persons.
The Shipping Corporation of Polynesia's ex-CEO comes in for stinging criticism. John Jonese, a New Zealander, tried to leave the country, but Attorney General John Cauchy successfully challenged that in court.
He's cutting his ties with Tonga, if you like, and so becomes quite a flight risk. There's nothing to bring him back here. If he was released to go to New Zealand.
The Shipping Corporation's company secretary accuses Mr. Jonese of misleading the board. Pesi Fanua says the findings have finally delved deep into many levels of Tonga's bureaucracy formerly hidden from view.
It's one of the most important things that this Royal Commission have done for Tonga is open up, enable us to see where all the problems are. In the old days, I suppose, as they say, ignorance is bliss. I mean, if you don't know, who cares, right? But now, people are hungry for it. You know. Either way, it will have to come out at the end.
Recommendations as to how to avoid it ever happening again, though, have been stalled for the time being. While parts of the report have been circulating in Parliament, the document is still awaiting to be tabled after its translation into Tongan.
Pacific Beat.
This is Pacific Beat. I'm Adam Connors. The Pacific is set to benefit from the strong resurgence in the East Asian economies, according to the World Bank's latest assessment released in Tokyo this week. The World Bank's half-yearly East Asia and Pacific Economic Update predicts growth for the region of 8.7% in 2010, almost a full percentage point higher than the forecast in its most recent assessment in November 2009. Chief Economist Vikram Nehru says East Asia will grow strongly despite the weakened world economy. Jemima Garrett asked Dr. Nehru how much of the growth Papua New Guinea, Fiji and the Pacific Islands are likely to see.
The Pacific Islands will see the impact of the 8.7% indirectly through a number of means. The first and foremost, I would think, is through commodity prices. As you know, a large part of that 8.7% is coming from China. And China is needs a huge amount of commodity imports to support that support its growth rate, which we are projecting to be 9.5% in 2010. And to the extent that the Pacific Islands supply some of these commodities, they are certainly going to benefit.
Do you think the Pacific will also see a flow on from the impact China's having on the Australian economy and then that flowing through to tourism to the region?
Exactly. That's going to be a second channel through which the East Asia resurgence is going to impact the Pacific. It's indirectly through Australia and New Zealand. Australia and New Zealand have benefited actually quite a lot from the fiscal stimulus package of China. And thanks to the fact that they have thereby had a fairly reasonable growth performance given what's happening elsewhere in the world, the Pacific Islands have been indirect beneficiaries of that.
Papua New Guinea is being buoyed by its new LNG project, but the World Bank is warning that that raises increased risks of inflationary problems. How should the Papua New Guinea government respond to that?
The Papua New Guinea government actually already has in place a fiscal rule which requires that the deficit that they have is kept within certain bounds. Now they've exceeded the deficit during the crisis and perhaps for good reason. But the important point is that such fiscal rules are critical to make sure that when there are large inflows of foreign exchange that come into an economy, as the LNG project will deliver for Papua New Guinea, it's important that those resources are initially saved and then gradually used over a period of time to make sure that the use is non-inflationary and that it can be used for long-term development of the economy. So for PNG, the key point is how well will they be able to implement the fiscal rules that they already have in place.
In contrast, Fiji had its worst economic performance in a decade in 2009. How are things looking for Fiji in 2010?
Very difficult, isn't it? They've obviously been hit by natural disasters. There are strained relations with the aid and the international community. So things are likely to be difficult, but we still expect that 2010 is going to be better than 2009.
Vanuatu is a standout performer in the Pacific, and it doesn't have anything particular like the LNG that Papua New Guinea has. Why is Vanuatu doing so much better?
Several things. First of all, Vanuatu has had very good macroeconomic management. It's had a period of political stability. It's done well on things like agriculture, construction, tourism, and so forth. And actually, it's been an indirect beneficiary of what's happening in Fiji, because many tourists from Australia and New Zealand, rather than going to Fiji, have been ending up in Vanuatu. So it goes to show that if countries do get their acts together, even though they're disadvantaged by distance and size, they can still do well by attracting investment and by attracting tourists and by being able to export.
Dr. Vikram Nehru, the World Bank's chief economist for East Asia and the Pacific, speaking with Jemima Garrett. The political parties that make up the coalition government in Solomon Islands have agreed to contest the upcoming national elections under a common policy platform. The six coalition partners that form what is known as the Sanura government, led by Prime Minister Derek Sakua, agreed on the election strategy during a one-day retreat this week. The General Secretary of the Solomon Islands Democratic Party and one of the coalition partners, John Kenia-Pasea, explains to Sam Seke why they have decided to contest on a common platform.
There was an overwhelming support based on the fact that Sinura has done a lot of good things for the country, and yet we feel that a lot of good things we could have done, we ran out of time to do it. And therefore, the coalition has decided that they will, for continuity, for peace and stability, for responsible leadership purposes, the coalition partners have agreed to sign a pre-coalition agreement going into the elections. Now, what this basically means is that the individual parties will go out on their own and campaign, but they will adopt a common policy platform. And then when they return after the elections, they will move quickly under the terms and conditions of the pre-election coalition agreement to form the next government as soon as possible. So basically, I think that was the nutshell of what was agreed on at the retreat.
Now, you mentioned that the whole idea was based on your success. Can you give us some examples briefly of the successes that you have achieved?
I think the notable one was a restoration of confidence and trust in government, and also restoring relations with neighbors and international community, governments and donor agencies. The other one, of course, was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and the other associated ones are Commission of Land Inquiry into Land Dealings on Koro Canal, as well as releasing the 2009 draft, federal draft constitution, which is now going through provincial review. Now, remember, that one has been going on for 10 years and nothing concrete has been happening. Of course, the other things are things like gold rich mining. Within less than 18 months or two years, we've been able to set down the groundwork and platform from which gold rich should begin operation as soon as possible in the later part of this year or 2010.
How practical is it, you know, six political groups? How do you decide whose political parties' policies should be included in the campaign platform?
I think it's easy because when we say a common platform, you only have to go back to a point of reference which is not too far back, and that is our current Sinura policy statement.
The General Secretary of the Solomon Islands Democratic Party, John Kenia-Pasea. The four-year term of the current parliament will end on April the 24th, and no date has yet been set for fresh general elections. That's it for this edition of Pacific Beat. We'll be back at the same time next week with another weekend edition of the program. And a reminder that our afternoon edition of Pacific Beat can be heard Monday to Friday throughout the Pacific from 5 p.m. Suva time. That's 3 p.m. in Port Moresby. So from me, Adam Connors, thanks for your company and have a good day. Take care.